Appropriation Officer of the Queen's University, Ireland, from the University of Cambridge, where he's lecturer in Sanskrit in the Asian and Middle Eastern Studies Department. And he's got deep interest in Sanskrit grammar and the traditions of Sanskrit grammar. And he's published on the Kashika Vritti, edited that text, if I recall. And he's got interest in Tamil and Sanskrit, a relationship between Tamil and Sanskrit as well. And today he's going to speak to us on a lecture entitled Panini's Grammar and the Destiny of Sanskrit Around the Beginning of the Common Era. Thank you.
Thank you, Gavin. Thank you, everyone, for attending this lecture. I hope you won't be horrified. I'll need to take this closer because otherwise I don't see. I find that accounts of the history of Sanskrit, from its hoary Vedic beginnings to its dominant role in South Asia in later times and up to early modernity, often have a teleological flavour, as if it had been its predetermined destiny to become the language of classical and medieval Indian culture. And usually most narratives link the history of Sanskrit to that of Brahmanism, and this in turn is traced back to the authority and prestige of the holy Vedic texts that the Brahmanical culture has, at least in most of its manifestations, considered as its fountainhead. This approach is a reflection of the orthodox Brahmanical belief that a natural intimate connection exists between Brahmanhood and Sanskrit in the dharmic order of the cosmos, making Sanskrit as an essential component of the sociocultural identity of Brahmins. Throughout the centuries and across South Asia, Brahmins have emphatically claimed the superiority of Sanskrit over other languages for any intellectual endeavor worthy of this name, a claim with strong spiritual, moral, and aesthetic overtones, for besides its expressiveness, they have also praised the divine nature, purity, and beauty of Sanskrit. Given these premises, one would expect Sanskrit to be the sole preserve of Brahmanical authors and its use to be confined to the religious and philosophical domain. However, the historical picture we are confronted with from at least the beginning of the Common Era is one in which, in more than one sense, the domain of Sanskrit does not entirely overlap with that of Brahmanism. Not only other languages were also used by Brahmanical authors, but even more strikingly, the other major religions of India, of ancient India, Buddhism and Jainism, also employed Sanskrit on a large scale, although they did it with a markedly distinct ideological and emotional attitude. Moreover, not all the uses of Sanskrit can be regarded as religious in any deeply meaningful sense of the term, for the hegemony of Sanskrit was even more absolute in secular domains, such as medicine, astronomy, poetics, mathematics, and a number of other expert traditions or systems of knowledge, than in that of religious literature. And most importantly, for many centuries, Sanskrit was also the predominant language of that essentially courtly genre that was Kavya, and of inscriptions, saturating the sphere of public political discourse not just in South Asia, but across large swathes of Southeast Asia. In recent years, the debate on these topics has been dominated by the thesis expounded by Sheldon Pollock in his influential 2006 book, or maybe it's earlier than that, The Language of Gods in the World of Men. And so in a sense, it's inevitable to start from there. In a nutshell, Pollock links the beginning of the hegemony of Sanskrit to the development in the early centuries of the Common Era of a courtly culture epitomized by the invention of Kavya, a specific kind, as you know, of ornate poetry. In parallel to the latter, the closely related genre of the epigraphic prashasti, the royal eulogy, marks the appropriation of Sanskrit for the purposes of political discourse, a phenomenon that on the basis of the available archaeological evidence appears to have been initiated in the early centuries of the Common Era by ruling dynasties of foreign origin, notably the Western Kshatrapas, to Ashakas, that is, Scythians, and later the Kushanas. Ashaka ruler Rudradaman is responsible for the famous inscription of Junagar in today's Gujarat, dating to circa 150 CE, or the Common Era, the first known inscription that contains a proper prashasti. According to Pollock, these foreign dynasties adopted and promoted Sanskrit, quote, to participate in the prestige economy of Sanskrit, but they and the poets and intellectuals they patronized began to expand that economy by turning Sanskrit into an instrument of polity and the mastery of Sanskrit into a source of personal charisma, unquote. I fully agree with Pollock when he writes that one should reject this, quote, this is more of a collage of Pollock's sentences, one should reject the standard account of Sanskrit cultural political history, seeking to explain these developments by postulating a resurgence of Brahmanism. As they posit, the resurgence of a community we have no reason to believe was in any need of resurgence at the beginning of the Common Era, that is. A reassertion at the expense of Buddhism, which in fact hardly suffered a subsequent decline, unquote. However, while it is unquestionable that the epigraphic use of Sanskrit and the emergence of Kavya are phenomena that mark a new phase in the history of Sanskrit and surely reflect important socio-political changes, I differ from Pollock when he writes that, quote, everything we know or can infer about the nature of Sanskrit culture for the entire first millennium BCE shows the prevalence of its liturgical dimension, the form of knowledge necessary for liturgy, and the restriction of its use to those alone who participated in this form of life. A steady state of literary cultural convention that was exploded in the early centuries of the first millennium, unquote. It seems to me that Pollock's almost unilateral focus on Kavya, on the one hand, to the detriment of other cultural forms that can be subsumed under the label Shastra, and on the courts as a motor of cultural innovation, neglecting the role, for example, of Buddhist and Jain monastic organizations, of Brahmanical scholarly networks and institutions, leads to an oversight of some important factors that played a decisive role in the processes that led to the dominance of Sanskrit. In short, while Pollock claims that it would be hard to find historical precedents to the phenomena he chooses to put center stage, I believe, on the contrary, that these were prepared and facilitated by certain significant post-Vedic developments. My contention is that while the prestige of the association of Sanskrit with Brahmanical learning may have prompted the Shakas and others to adopt it for the purposes of political communication, prestige alone is neither the only nor the most decisive factor in the phenomena we are dealing with. Other factors, both pragmatic and ideological, all of which emerged well before the beginning of the Common Era, contributed to ensuring Sanskrit its unique position. Among these, today I mainly focus on its precocious grammatization, along with its supra-regional character, and its early elaboration of conceptual structures and specialized terminology for abstract systematic discourse. I will outline a broad picture of this crucial formative period in South Asian cultural history, taking into account the few facts we know and trying to weave them together into what will sound, I hope, like a plausible narrative. It is, I admit, a narrative mostly based on circumstantial evidence and with many gaps and obscurities, which will certainly need to be revised in the future in light of both possible new findings and a better understanding of the sociocultural processes, dynamics involved. So forgive me if my account will in places sound fuzzy or, on the contrary, over-speculative. This is, after all, a direct consequence, I think, of the nature of the materials available to all researchers of ancient civilizations, and perhaps especially so of ancient India. So, going back to grammar. Grammar, Vyakarana in Sanskrit, has been generally considered to be at the very heart of the Brahmanical culture. There is consensus about the fact that grammar, and especially Panini's grammar, helped making Sanskrit the dominant linguistic medium of pre-modern South Asia. However, this role has mostly been described in rather vague terms as originating from its Vedic antecedents, an explanation that I find insufficient to account for its pivotal position in South Asian culture. The origins of grammar go back to many centuries before the period I focus on. Grammar stemmed, as you certainly know, from the milieu of the Vedic schools that were committed to the preservation and transmission of the sacred texts. To this purpose, the ritualists developed specific techniques of memorization and recitation that allowed them to double-check the correctness of the text being transmitted. One such technique is called padapata, or recitation word by word, based on the analysis of the continuous text into its components through the isolation of inflected words and the undoing of sandhis, that is, the phonetic changes occurring at word boundaries. Occasionally, this type of analysis would go further, dividing words into smaller units, for instance, isolating preverbs and some nominal endings, splitting compounds, and so on. This eventually led to the emergence of grammar as one of the Vedangas, the six scholarly disciplines that in various ways integrated and sustained the ritual activity.
Sorry? Can you say that again?
Yes. This eventually led to the emergence of grammar as one of the Vedangas, the six scholarly disciplines that in various ways integrated and sustained the ritual activity. There is little doubt that Vyakarana as a Vedanga is the foundation on which the architecture of Panini's grammar rests. This is clearly suggested by the partial continuity of the latter's conceptual and terminological apparatus with that of the earlier tradition. But on the other hand, I think it can be shown that in many ways Panini's work, the Ashtadhyayi, represents a sharp epistemological rupture with the ritually oriented Vedic linguistic speculation. I will try, without being too technical, to illustrate some major aspects of this intellectual turn and discuss the historical circumstances in which that I believe made it possible. But to begin with, let me briefly summarize what we know, or rather believe to know, about Panini. The information about Panini's life is scant, as is frequently the case even with much later Indian authors. In the case of Panini, we are in fact relatively lucky, because the Indian tradition has handed down that he hailed from a place called Shalatura, which has been located near today's Peshawar in North Pakistan, in the region known at the time as Gandhara. The credibility of this tradition appears to be confirmed by some studies of Madhav Deshpande that have found significant typological similarities between the variety of Sanskrit described by Panini and Gandhari, the later Prakrit from that region. In the second half of the first millennium BCE, Gandhara was a region that had intense relations with Western and Central Asia and was exposed to foreign cultural influences, meaning non-Indian. Around 518 BCE, Darius I of Persia conquered it. There is no scholarly consensus on how long the Achaemenid rule lasted and in what forms, but the available data indicate that the Achaemenids still exercised some form of control over the area when Alexander the Great's army arrived in India in 327 BCE. It is certainly due to this intense and prolonged interaction with the Achaemenid Empire that writing was introduced to India. Since the first script that appears to have been used to write an Indic language is the so-called Kharoshthi, a right-to-left alphabet that is modeled after the Aramaic script used in the Persian Empire. Hispanian is generally assigned to a period between the 6th and the 4th century BCE, but I'll have more to say about Panini's date in a while. He should have therefore lived during or soon after the period in which the Persians had control over Gandhara. Other arguments that have been used in the past to date Panini are based on rather impressionistic evidence. Patanjali, the author of the Mahabhashya, the earliest surviving commentary on Panini's Ashtadhyayi, is usually dated around the mid-2nd century BCE because, commenting on a sutra that deals with the use of a certain past tense, it's 3-11 Anadyata Nailang, he gives an example that refers to a Yavana, a Greek or Westerner, who had besieged Saketa, a town that more or less corresponds to present-day Ayodhya, around his time. The latter has been tentatively identified with the Indo-Greek king Menander, who lived around the mid-2nd century BCE. So considering that Patanjali's commentary incorporates an earlier commentary, the Vartika of Katyayana, and allowing some gap between these two authors and then between Katyayana and Panini, scholars have placed the latter at least 2 centuries before. This is the main piece of external evidence, and as it is easy to see, is highly conjectural. In 1989, von Hinüber has drawn attention to a piece of internal evidence that many researchers consider quite reliable, namely a sutra 5-120, Rupad Ahata Prashansayo Yap, that allows the derivation of the word rupia, coin, in the sense of ahata, literally struck, that is a punch-marked coin. On the basis of Cribb's work on Indian numismatics, von Hinüber has asserted that Panini cannot be dated long before 350 BCE, which is around the time when this type of coins are attested for the first time in the subcontinent. Such a relatively late date opens the way to paves the way to an intriguing scenario, namely one in which Panini might have composed his grammar in a culture that had already become literate, albeit shortly before his time. The question whether it is possible for a sophisticated grammar like such as Panini's, or indeed for any grammar, to be the product of a purely oral culture has often been raised by modern scholarship. Now, there is not a shred of evidence for the existence of writing in India before the 3rd century BCE, as convincingly argued by a number of authoritative scholars in recent years, such as Salomon, von Hinüber, Falk, and Fussmann. As is known, the earliest attestation of writing is found in the inscriptions of the Maurya Emperor Ashoka, which are in Magadhi, a variety of Eastern Prakrit. Most of these are in Brahmi, the progenitor of all later South and Southeast Asian scripts, but a few of them in the Northwest are in Kharoshthi. Nevertheless, it also seems likely that Kharoshthi was invented sometimes before its earliest epigraphic attestations. If Panini lived in Gandhara around the mid-4th century BCE, in all likelihood, not only was he aware of the Aramaic script, but also may have known and perhaps used the Kharoshthi script. So while the chronology is uncertain, it does not entirely preclude the possibility that Panini belonged to a cultural horizon that was no longer entirely oral. In my opinion, there are much more compelling theoretical reasons, however, to conjecture that Panini's grammar could not have been composed in the absence of writing. And this is why I chose this as the image, in a sense, for that sums what I'm trying to say.
How does the Vedas come into it? Rig Veda must have been before that, more than 3,000 years ago.
Well, certainly a long time before. I'll answer questions at the end, maybe.
Okay.
I suspect that whoever designed this stamp hadn't really just assumed that, of course, in order to produce such a complex work, Panini must have known writing. I mean, we can't imagine an intellectual at work without some kind of writing instrument at his hand, at his disposal. But as I said, I think they were right, in fact. Let me try to explain what these theoretical reasons are to assume, to hypothesize that Panini used writing. I refer to the work of a French historian of science called Sylvain Auroux, who has examined the rise of grammar in different pre-modern contexts, with a special focus on the ancient Near East and the Mediterranean region, observing that the birth of a full-fledged grammatical speculation seems to depend upon and hence follow the appearance of writing. He notes that while all cultures appear to have some kind of a bilinguistic knowledge, that is, some idea of what language is and how it functions, the transition to metalinguistic knowledge is only made possible when I quote Ohu here, language is posited as an object. It must be there before us, a manifestation of itself rather than of something else, contrary to what happens in its daily use. Writing is a remarkable process of objectification without any previous parallel. Producing a grammar is not just a matter of mnemonic skills, so well attested in ancient and modern India, but it implies a deep cognitive shift from orality, involving a number of complex intellectual operations. If we look at Panini's grammar, it becomes clear that many of its formulations presuppose the access to a bidimensional representation that is hardly conceivable in a purely oral culture. The basic elements of the Sanskrit language, roots, particles, suffixes, and so on, are decontextualized, that is, extrapolated from any immediate actual context, classified through a sophisticated metalanguage, and rearranged into paradigms and lists, which break away from the linearity of it of the spoken sequence. The Ashtadhyayi provides both the nomenclature of such grammatical elements and a set of rules for their recombination, leading to the formation of correct words and sentences. I will not go into too much detail, but let me give you a few examples. So this and the next one. Are actually the only two paradigms found in Panini's grammar. Both of them are found in what is actually one sutra, 412 in the case of the basic declensional endings, and 3478 for the basic finite verb endings. Oops. Being of a derivational or generative type, Panini's grammar does not need a separate paradigm for each declension or each verb tense or mood, as we are used to in Western grammatical books or textbooks of any language, including Sanskrit. It operates through the principle of substitution. In other words, these paradigms provide a set of endings that Panini postulates to be basic and then replaces with other endings whenever appropriate according to the declension or the verbal class, so according to certain formal conditions. Although I have added the frames, of course, some kind of tabular arrangement seems to me to be presupposed by Panini, since other rules in the Ashtadhyayi (101 and 102) assign designations concerning grammatical categories such as person for the verb, number for the verb, and then number alone for nominal endings. Apparently referring to their spatial representation by the use of expression as taken by three by three, trini, trini, and within these triplets, thus identified by the expression ekashaha, taken by one. So going back to the paradigms, this means so taken horizontally, these are first person in Sanskrit, third person in the Western grammatical terminology, second person, so first, middle, and last in Sanskrit, and again first, middle, and last. These are parasmaipada, these are manepada, and then taken one element each is singular, dual, plural, singular, dual, plural. So basically we have to being Italian I gesticulate a lot, but basically you have to imagine I don't know how to say it, but get to the exact slot by moving in a way which is not which is hardly imaginable, I think, in a purely oral culture. I mean, the fact that we're used to this kind of representation, for us they are absolutely obvious. But as I said, I think it's hardly imaginable in an oral culture. Even more interesting is the fact that in some cases an element may be replaced by lopa, which is defined by Panini as adarshana, not non-appearance or disappearance, and corresponds to what modern linguists would call a zero suffix. Now, in a positional that is sometimes one of these, well, it's actually more common with, with nominal endings. In some cases, a noun may not have any apparent suffix. I'll give you an example. This is a non-derived feminine noun, shala. So, in Panini's grammar, you first introduce, to derive the nominative singular of shala, you first introduce s, which is the usual, the basic nominal ending for the nominative singular. And then, because the name is feminine and then it ends in a long a, this s is replaced by lopa, that is a zero suffix, and so you get the nominative singular shala. Now, in a positional numerical system, zero is a place indicator, and its development is historically linked to the evolution of notation methods. Similarly, the idea behind Panini's lopa seems to be that, for example, in the inflection of a given class of nouns, the slot for a given case ending, in this case, in the case I've shown the nominative, the first one on the left, may appear empty, but the suffix is, in a sense, still there, and is fully functional both formally and semantically. Another example of what seems to me a strong indication of a literate culture is the device for forming pratyaharas, that is, abbreviations. It consists in taking the first item of a closed list and the technical marker Anubandha in Sanskrit attached to the last, and joining them together to form an artificial term that functions as a collective name for all the elements in the set. So, for example, this is a kind of repertoire of sounds of the Sanskrit language, which Panini needs to refer to in his grammar. For
Maheshwara Nishutrani. Maheshwara Nishutrani?
Yes, yeah.
Okay.
Or Pratyahara Sutras, that's another name. Pratyahara is the name, the word for abbreviation. So, for example, to refer to vowels, Panini calls them ach, which is an abbreviation formed with the first element here and the Anubandha, the technical marker. These are the letters in capital letters. So ach will include all the vowels. Hal will include the consonants. Hash will be the voiced consonant. Again, this is a kind of mechanism which is much more easy to imagine came into being in a it's difficult to imagine how the idea could originate without being grounded in some sort of graphic representation. Trying to combine these considerations with the various bits of historical information and internal evidence I've summarized earlier, I would like to suggest the following scenario, which to me seems to answer some major questions in the most satisfactory way, although I'm aware that much of it is highly speculative and other interpretations are, of course, equally possible. The Brahmins of Gandhara, of whom Panini was a member, were the first in the subcontinent to come into prolonged, intense contact with the literate civilization, and a sophisticated one for that matter. Because, as I said, the region's exposure to Persian influences and its political subjugations to the Achaemenid Empire around the mid-first millennium BCE. We do not know if they were directly involved in the process of adaptation of the Aramaic script that led to the development of Kharoshthi, or some now lost predecessor of it. But this has been suggested. This is a little map of the Kharoshthi alphabet, thanks to Wikipedia, I confess, because it was the only image I could easily. This has been suggested because, I don't know if you can see clearly, but anyway, basically all the consonants of an Indic language, all the retroflex and the aspirated consonants, which are so typical of Indo-Aryan languages, were already adequately represented in Kharoshthi. So there seems to and usually it takes time for an alphabet that is imported from a different culture and has been created for a different language to adjust to the phonological features of a new language. On the other hand, the length of short and long vowels were not distinguished. So we do not know if these Brahmins, who presumably were the heirs of a centuries-old tradition of linguistic speculation, were involved in it, in its creation. But it seems plausible to assume that precisely because of this background, they quickly realized the immense potential of writing and adopted it. The new technology in turn created the conditions, that is, writing, in turn created the conditions that allowed new cognitive attitudes to develop and led to an immense and probably collective effort of observation and collection of empirical data on the everyday language. And then to the subsequent work of analysis, classification and formalization of abstract elements such as roots, stems and affixes. Now, no trace or even memory has survived of this momentous enterprise of analysis. But within a few generations, the ground must have been laid for the composition of the Ashtadhyayi, which takes the analysis of the language and its findings for granted and moves on to the synthesis, teaching how to combine the basic elements in order to derive correct words and sentences. Just as the immediate prehistory of Panini's grammar is lost to us and can only be gauged from its outcome, namely the Ashtadhyayi, we are also in the dark about its propagation and reception in the centuries following its composition. Although by the beginning of the Common Era, it becomes clear that what is considered to be good Sanskrit is essentially Paninian Sanskrit. The process of dissemination certainly took time, and we have no clue as to who its agents were and what strategies they resorted to. The isolation of the Brahmanical communities of Gandhara, which in the final part of the first millennium BCE appears to have become peripheral to the geocultural horizon of Brahmanism, probably had its weight in slowing it down. In the Mahabhashya of Patanjali, Gandhara is considered to lie well outside the boundaries of Aryavarta, which roughly corresponds to the Gangetic plains, and is regarded as the land where good, correct Sanskrit is found. It may have therefore taken several decades before the new intellectual movement of Paninian Vyakarana reached the Brahmanical heartland, which had moved to the east, and gained popularity there. This may at least in part explain the divergence from the Paninian norm that is observed in certain varieties of Sanskrit found in texts from around the beginning of the Common Era, including the so-called Buddhist hybrid Sanskrit. Even though later on, of course, the peculiarities of a given dialect may have been intentionally preserved as a stylistic feature identifying a genre or a certain sectarian affiliation. Modern Paninian scholars have also remarked that at the times, even the earliest commentators, Katyayana and Patanjali, seem uncertain about the interpretation of some sutras, suggesting that the transmission of the text may have not been linear, and the exegetical tradition, whether oral or written, which certainly complemented it, may have suffered interruptions along the way. Again, this kind of situation is not unusual in any ancient context, but it is surprising, in a way, in a sense, in light of the importance of the rigorous formulation of Paninian rules. This is not a text which you can easily tamper with, because there's a kind of internal check inbuilt in its structure and in the wording of the sutras themselves. And on the other hand, it's also surprising in light of the fact that text seems to have been transmitted with very few interpolations and hardly any corruption. Interestingly, I think there were probably simply material factors that made the transmission difficult, but it's not unlikely that Panini's grammar also met with skepticism and opposition. In the Paspasha Aknika, the introductory chapter of the Mahabhashya, we find clues suggesting that the more conservative circles of orthodox Vedic ritualists leveled harsh criticism against Paninian grammar. In a long section discussing the purposes of grammar, Patanjali responds to the allegation that grammar is purposeless, arguing that it is needed to preserve and transmit the Vedas, to perform rites correctly, and so on. His ideological defense, which aims at vindicating the orthodoxy of the Shastra, sounds quite lame, I would say, and reveals the author's anxiety to make it accepted within Brahmanism. Occasionally, other themes emerge in the discussion. For example, when Patanjali claims that grammar is needed so that one does not speak like barbarians or like women, suggesting that in his eyes, good language was associated with rank, refinement, and learning. And in a completely different section, he makes the interesting statement that grammar is needed to recognize the good speakers, that he calls shishtas, so a select group, an elite of Brahmins who were learned, who had a frugal and lifestyle and lived in a certain part of Aryavarta. From that point of view, traditional Vedic ritualists had good reasons, I think, to be suspicious of grammar. While the original connection of Vyakarana to Vedic learning is unquestionable, even a superficial inspection of Panini's grammar shows that it is only marginally concerned with Vedic, that is, the variety of Sanskrit that is found in the Vedas. The language of the sacred texts is covered only partially as one domain or variety called chandas, literally meter or verse, of a much broader linguistic spectrum, and even then mostly treated as a deviation from a default register that is clearly a distinct and more recent variety of the language. There was undoubtedly a good deal of overlap between the two domains, especially if we look at late Vedic prose texts. But the crucial difference between them is that the mechanisms of the ordinary language are productive. That is, they can be used to form a potentially infinite number of new sentences. While in principle, the Vedic text is forever fixed and closed. Even though the Ashtadhyayi builds upon the Vedic linguistic legacy, it shows a profound discontinuity from earlier grammatical texts. As I have already noted, it widens its scope to embrace the Sanskrit language in its entirety. No doubt a high variety of Sanskrit, that is the idiolect used by the educated elites of Panini's time and place. From then on, the grammarians will keep the two domains of the language, Laukika and Vaidika, distinct, as is clearly stated at the very beginning of the Mahabhashya, when Patanjali declares that grammar is Shabdanushasana, the instruction of words, and replies to the question, which words, Kesham Shabdanam, saying both worldly and Vedic, Laukikanam Vaidikanam cha. Another striking difference marking a significant cognitive break from its Vedic antecedents is the separation of practice and theory one finds in Panini's grammar. While earlier grammatical texts were directly related to the purpose of the preservation and transmission of particular corpora, namely the scriptures of specific Vedic shakas, Vedic branches, the Ashtadhyayi seems to have achieved a remarkable degree of autonomy from any immediate practical interest. It is in no way a didactic instrument for the teaching of Sanskrit. Its internal arrangement is completely counterintuitive and shows such levels of complexity and abstraction that readers can only find their way through its rules if they already know Sanskrit and with a good deal of grammatical training. Nor is it a textbook for good eloquence or refined literary style. This is not to say that Panini and his predecessors were prompted by the mere pursuit of knowledge for knowledge's sake. We can only guess their motivations, since the Ashtadhyayi does not contain any statement of intentions and principles. But my conjecture is that they were responding to the perception of a rapid change in the language and the resulting threat to their linguistic and cultural identity. A perception certainly exacerbated by the fact that they had been left behind, as it were, by the expansion of Brahmanism towards the south and the east, in a frontier region where foreign cultural influences were conspicuous and strong. I think it would be difficult to overrate the importance of this epistemological break. For the first time, as far as we know, in the history of Brahmanism, a worldly phenomenon, namely everyday language, rises to the role of a worthy object of systematic knowledge. Moreover, this knowledge is mainly based not on traditional authority, but rather on empirical observation. The world, loka, namely one's everyday experience within a community of speakers, is the source of authority for a grammarian, as the Mahabhashya states more than once. This is clearly as much an epistemological break as the rupture of a symbolic order. Grammar reveals itself as a secular enterprise that displaces the Vedas and Vedic ritualism from the center of Brahmanical concerns, as is proven by the, I think, or in, suggested by the orthodox reactions that can be evinced from the discussions in the Mahabhasha I mentioned earlier. I'm aware that my claim that language described by Panini is the everyday language in use in his community would be unacceptable to many Indologists. Throughout the history of Paninian scholarship, many have maintained that language described by Panini was never an authentic, real, spontaneous language used for the purposes of daily communication. Most recently, this opinion has been reiterated by Pollock. I go back there, as I said, simply because he's the last person who has written extensively on these topics, who writes that, quote, "For most of the first millennium or more of Sanskrit existence in South Asia, we have virtually no indubitable evidence for its employment in any domain we would call this worldly, the realm outside the practices of the sacred and the forms of knowledge necessary for the sacred." And talking specifically about the Ashtadhyayi, Pollock claims that in this text, this sacerdotal function characterizes both registers of the language. On the one hand, the idiom actually used for the Vedic texts themselves. On the other, the rigorously normative idiolect restricted to Vedic pedagogical environments. Unquote. I think we need to approach the issue of the nature of the language described by Panini with greater historical and sociolinguistic subtlety. To begin with, the above claims about the nature of Sanskrit inevitably raise the question of the origin of this supposedly unauthentic language. One should not confuse literary language, which is all we have access to anyway, with artificial or with disconnected from any contemporary linguistic practices. As to what extent the Sanskrit described by Panini was a spoken language in the sense of a language spontaneously learned by children within the family, we have to admit that this is ultimately impossible to decide. But we should keep in mind a couple of aspects that hold for Sanskrit as for any other language. Firstly, linguistic change does not happen overnight, but is a gradual process, which is likely to proceed at a different pace in different localities of a speaking community, if a speaking community is spread over a vast area. It is certainly possible that the relatively isolated Brahmanical community of Gandhara may have been more conservative in its linguistic practice precisely because of its isolation. And just to give you an example of how this happens, so it's happened in a number of situations in the history of humanity. In the early 20th century, Jewish communities that had been expelled from Spain in 1492 were still using, in southeastern Europe, were still using an archaic variety of Catalan within the community, simply because it was the core of their identity as Jews of West European origin. And different varieties of the same language can well coexist side by side, and to some extent mix and overlap in different social layers of the same population. Moreover, as the experience of any of us who have learned a second language shows, even a language acquired through formal or informal learning can become a spontaneous tool of communication in the subjective cognitive experience of the speakers. What is important in our case is that if we look at the Ashtadhyayi closely, everything suggests that the language described by Panini was not confined to liturgical or scholastic uses. To begin with, there is the remarkable evidence provided by the vocabulary incorporated in his grammar. It is hard to imagine that its richness and variety is functional to a communication exclusively restricted to highly formalized and strictly regulated contexts of social interaction. See, for example, the names of menial occupations, tools, foods, plants, animals, and so on, or expressions such as soup aprati, a little soup, dantura, having bucked teeth, patres amita, a sponger, kauleiaka, a hybrid dog, or the set of rules concerning the intonation to be used in greetings according to the relative rank of the people involved. Even more than the lexicon, though, I regard as especially significant the subtlety of many of Panini's semantic and pragmatic annotations. For example, all those rules where he uses, I won't give you the Sanskrit terms, but where the semantic condition for the derivation of words as sentences are feelings or attitudes such as sympathy, irony, praise, anger, criticism, scorn, insult, menace, torment, and so on, which again is difficult to imagine as having any weight in a ritual context or in a scholastic context. And equally significant, I think, is the deliberate vagueness of other formulations, such as the overlap of the semantic conditions for the derivation of different verbal forms. Surely, if one sets about to describe the language of a corpus and its strictly regulated extratextual uses, one would avoid the annoying ambiguities of ordinary language, which were faithfully recorded instead by Panini. Moreover, instead of striving after exhaustiveness, which is possible if you're dealing with a limited corpus, Panini seems sometimes content with leaving his formulations open or blurred at the margins, probably an implicit recognition that certain linguistic devices, say the use of certain suffixes, were not just productive, but in fact able to expand in unexpected directions, or in other words, that Sanskrit, like any natural language, was in a state of constant change. This evidence may not be decisive, but it's certainly strongly evocative of quite a varied range of contexts of use. And I think I'm quite close, so I should decide how to cut it. Well, the road might have been long and bumpy, but by the beginning of the Common Era, Panini's grammar had come to be probably almost universally recognized as the standard of good Sanskrit. It's not a mere coincidence, I believe, that the few centuries after the grammatization of Sanskrit also saw its emergence as the dominant language of literary culture and political communication. I borrow the term grammatization again from Sylvain Auroux. Apparently it's got stuck. This doesn't go. It doesn't move. There should be one more. Yes. Yeah.
Sorry.
So, Auroux defines grammatization as the process that leads to describing and equipping a language by means of two technologies, which are the basis of our metalinguistic knowledge, grammar and dictionary. And he remarks that the appearance of linguistic tools does not leave human linguistic practices untouched. With grammatization, and to large extent, thanks to it, a space-time continuum of communication is constituted, the dimensions and homogeneity of which are incommensurable with that which can be found in an oral society, namely one without grammar. So who calls grammar a technology, by which I understand that grammar empowers a biologically based human faculty such as speech, making it achieve results that would not otherwise be possible. Much in the same way as tools or machines allow humans to go faster or reach higher or to potentiate their senses. Panini's enterprise codified the norm of correctness, thus ensuring that Sanskrit remains stable and consistently reproducible, to a large extent unaffected by linguistic change due to time and regional variation. Equipped with a full-fledged grammar, Sanskrit thus became the optimal linguistic medium for emerging forms of social and political discourse, new cultural practices and institutions that transcended regional, linguistic, ethnic and religious diversities. Thanks to Panini's grammar, Sanskrit linguistic practices, both written and oral, became subject to well-defined rules and could be assessed by an objective textualized standard, giving it a remarkable advantage over the local languages, which, being non-codified, showed much greater internal variation and were subject to the incessant erosion of linguistic change. Now, there were two other factors I think also mattered in this history. One is that a linguistic medium, what I would call the cosmopolitanism of Sanskrit, a linguistic medium with such a robust potential for universal application must have had enormous appeal for any social actors who aspired to operate on a level that transcended locality. Even from this point of view, Sanskrit had an advantage over local languages insofar as in the course of the first millennium BCE, it had lost any localized ethnocentric dimension, if it ever had one. Through the propagation of Vedic schools, through the expansion of Brahmanical groups over an increasingly vast territory, which before the beginning of the Common Era had already come to include more or less the whole of present-day North India. This is roughly the area that both the Mahabhashya and sometime later, the Manusmriti call Aryavarta, although there are some differences between the two texts as to the exact definition. But that's roughly the area included between the Himalayas in the north and the Vindhyas in the south, and stretching from coast to coast. The very concept of Aryavarta probably betrays a very different historical reality, one in which many twice-borns were already living outside the boundaries of Aryavarta. One can imagine, therefore, that well before the beginning of the Common Era, there were Brahmanical communities scattered over most of North India and perhaps beyond, who spoke different local varieties of the same old Indo-Aryan language, but used the highest register, what we call Sanskrit, as the common language in their interactions, certainly in scholarly circles and probably to varying degrees in more mundane contexts. The cosmopolitanism of Sanskrit, potentiated by grammar, must have been apparent and appealing also to the new anti-Brahmanical movements, which were proselytizing religions with universalistic aspirations. It's not surprising then that from the end of the first millennium BCE, some Buddhist sects, while certainly preaching and teaching in the local languages, felt compelled to resort to Sanskrit when they began engaging with Brahmins on the intellectual level, competing for the patronage of rulers, merchants, and other elites. At least in India, Buddhism quickly embraced Sanskrit for its literary production, to the virtual exclusion of other languages. Well, I have a few very interesting quotes from early Buddhist texts, but I'll skip them in order to conclude. Besides its grammatization and supra-regional dimension, another factor that I think contributed to ensuring Sanskrit its unique position in South Asian history is the fact that Brahmanical the Brahmanical traditions of learning that evolved in the post-Vedic period. Some of them the direct descendants of the ancient Vedangas, quite naturally adopted Sanskrit as their linguistic medium. The ritualistic speculation associated with the cultivation of Vedic learning provided the model from which later forms of systematic thought and philosophical investigation evolved. One striking example of this is the sutra genre, with its highly formalistic and terse style. Tool evidence developed in the domain of kalpa ritual and then exported to Dharmashastra, Vyakarana, Mimamsa, Vaisheshika, and so on. These post-Vedic intellectual traditions elaborated conceptual structures and specialized terminologies for their systems. In parallel, various and increasingly distinct secular systems of knowledge, such as medicine, astronomy, mathematics, law, erotics, dramaturgy, statecraft, emerged around the same time or shortly after. Medicine, for example, is already mentioned by Patanjali as one of the domains in which Sanskrit is used and which one should look when deciding what's in use and what's not in use in the language. For these new theoretical enterprises, opting for Sanskrit as the linguistic medium allowed immediate access to a well-established sphere of abstract argumentative discourse, regardless of the religious affiliation of the individual authors and practitioners, and reflected their ambition to address a pan-Indian audience. Thus, grammar seems to have pioneered in the advent of a whole new universe of intellectual inquiry that around the beginning of the Common Era had already produced important works. Like the Arthashastra, which recently Olivelle and MacLeish have dated around between 100 BCE and 100 CE, many other early works from that period are already highly refined examples of their own genres, such as the Manava Dharma Shastra, the Natya Shastra, the major Ayurvedic treatises of Charaka, Sushruta, and Bela, or in a completely different realm, the early poetry of Ashvaghosha. Although the relative and absolute chronology of these works is notoriously uncertain and open to debate, the cumulative evidence suggests a prehistory sufficiently long to allow certain spheres of literary practice to emerge, mature and develop their own specific discursive and stylistic conventions and modes of argumentation, or in the field of poetry, their own imagery and repertoire of meters, tropes, and other stylistic devices. To conclude, I'm convinced that we can only hope to provide a plausible account of the early history of Sanskrit by taking account of a plurality of stakeholders and a multiplicity of social, cultural, and political factors. There are, of course, still many unanswered questions, for some of which I'm afraid no satisfying solution may ever be found. But as I've tried to show in this lecture, among these factors, grammar played a crucial role at different levels, opening the way to a number of developments that indelibly marked the history of pre-modern South Asia. Thank you.
I have a question about this Kharastoja alphabet. What's the link between that and Devanagari?
Sorry, I didn't hear you.
You talked about Kharosti. What is the link between that and Devanagari?
There's no direct link. About one century later, a new script was invented, which was written from left to right, probably
influenced by Greek, which by the Greek script that by then had been known, had become known to Indians. Okay. But Brahmi follows the same principles as Kharoshtiu, which are the same principles as Devanagari, all Indic scripts. That is, the sign for the consonant has the intrinsic short a. The vowels, unless they are in initial position, are written as diacritics above or below or on the right and the left. So apparently it was the same logic that governed both Kharoshtiu and Brahmi, except that they're written in two different directions.
Okay, thank you.
And the science of Brahmi seems to not necessarily derive from those of Kharoshtiu. But I'm not an expert on this ancient language.
You may very well be right, but just thinking of possible arguments against your position, I wondered whether the experts in... I've always been very impressed by the skill of the Rig Vedic poetry, the immense sophistication there. And if you speak poetry, each line is going to be metrically somewhat like its predecessor, even if you haven't written it down. And that gives one the two dimensions that appeared in your first slide about the paradigms. You had columns and rows, essentially. And it seems to me that poetry offers columns and rows, even if it's oral. And therefore, the ideas of classifying things in that way might have come from poetics.
Certainly, I mean, generally speaking, if you don't mind, I will... certainly you don't need writing to classify things in general. Of course, the human mind is always, even long before writing, is prone to classify things, to put order in the variety of the universe around us. What's different here, though, I think, is that they're not classifying elements that are found in a natural state. So they're not ordering, you know, the words that are used in poetry. They are analyzing language in a way which is not at all obvious if language is something that you bring inside yourself. What I think is convincing, what I find a strong argument, is the fact that if language is language is so much a part of us and our lives, that unless it's somehow outside you, you cannot start developing a reflection where you can move beyond the stage where you simply have ideas about language, which are found in old cultures, I think. But you start a process of analysis which leads to the birth of grammar. It's interesting, for example, that, again, historically it seems that grammars develop more easily in a context where you have inflected languages, like Sanskrit, or in a completely different cultural area, Japanese, but not, for example, with Chinese, which is an isolating language. So where words are not formed by putting together elements, but in a completely different way as with certain languages, even a sophisticated culture like the Chinese culture didn't develop that kind of grammatical speculation. But when you start writing down things, then the recurrence of certain elements in inflected language is apparently so striking that you have this phenomenon of the birth of grammar happening with Greek, Latin, already actually with the languages of ancient Mesopotamia.
is that you find cuneiform tablets with paradigms or lists of words. The important thing is that they are taken away from any immediate signifying context, and that's the difference with the poetry you mentioned before, I think.
It still seems to me that sort of metrical patterns, for the layperson, they're just felt, they're so implicit.
Mm.
But the poet might think about feet, for instance, repeating themselves in successive lines. But anyway...
I think, you know, we see grammar being brought in different contexts, in different cultural areas. What's striking in the Indian case is the level of sophistication grammar reached so early. And that's certainly because it had a long previous history that goes back to probably what you're saying, is a strong awareness of the forms of language, of meters, of... that kind of background was a very fertile ground for the emergence of this kind of highly abstract. And I think the writing was the decisive element that make it possible, I mean, that made the leap of quality happen. But, of course, I can't prove it.
But fortunately, we have to come to a close now. I found that absolutely fascinating. I was thinking also, something I'd like to talk to you about later, perhaps, is there's an implicit thesis in here about the link between the development of science and the development of the alphabet. But you, almost you're saying that you couldn't have a science without writing, in a way, perhaps.
I hadn't thought of it, actually.
Oh, okay.
The problem is that we do not know what... to what extent oral cultures are able to reach? Because they don't leave traces.
Mm, mm. Well, thank you so much for coming to talk to us, Dr. Gianni, and we'll give you a round of applause. For
thank you.
You. I thank you all for coming.